Welcome, everyone, to Film Strips, the podcast finally looking at a film by Alfred Hitchcock, although we covered Roger Corman first. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser.
Yeah, there was probably a better way I could have phrased that, but I didn't, and we're not going to do another take, so...
Well, it's one of those, sorry, Alf, but what have you done for me lately?
Yes, yes, that is true, that is true. But, so yes, everyone, welcome back to the show. This is the podcast in which every episode we discuss a movie, and if it has to somehow connect back to the film we discussed last time. And, Andrew, what are we discussing this week?
This week, we are looking at, well, as Dave said, one of the films by the great man of cinema himself, Alfred Hitchcock. But instead of something a little bit more familiar, we're actually taking the back roads through his filmography. We are following, was it Heather Angel?
It was Heather Angel. Angel.
Yeah. We are following her from last week's premature burial to the year 1941, where Alfred Hitchcock made a little film called Suspicion, which probably not as celebrated or fondly remembered as some of his more notable works, but I think it also does a number of interesting things, and it does show its uniquely Hitchcockian tendencies. But I think we have some matters to get to first.
Just briefly, as we've sort of noted on this show, for anybody who's been a longtime listener, you and I, Andrew, are longtime film students and spent time at the same film program at the exact same university, one Wilfrid Laurier, here in Ontario, Canada. And, like I said, we don't usually make much deals about our past or what we do outside of the podcast, but... In this instance, there is a prof that I at least had at Wilfrid Laurier University who passed away recently. That is Dr. Paul Hare. And it's no word of lie and not an exaggeration to say that Paul Hare is one of the single best people I ever had the opportunity and privilege to learn from. While at that school, I took many courses with him, including stuff related to Orson Welles and science fiction film. I highly recommend picking up any one of his wide number of books that he wrote over the years, if anybody's looking to dive into his film academic work. He was a communications professor, though, as well, I should certainly note. And his recent passing, he will be missed, and certainly I think it is a tremendous loss for both the students in the future and for those of us who knew him. So kudos to you, Dr. Hare.
Well, yes, there are many people who come into a classroom and read from a syllabus and grade your tests. And while I didn't have the privilege of studying under Dr. Paul Hare, the sheer amount of love and support that I've been seeing people putting online since his passing, I think it's a testament to the fact that, yeah, there are some profs that break from the mold. They become the people who educate us and inspire us, and in the case of you and I, you know, help us realize that, well, maybe 10, 15 years later, you can, too, spend your evenings sitting down and talking about Alfred Hitchcock films with a friend far away. All it takes is that one prof, and it certainly sounded like Dr. Paul Hare was that kind of prof.
Absolutely. But yeah, so with that, I guess it's time we return to our regularly scheduled program, as it were. So, Andrew, Suspicion, this is your pick this week. And I gotta say, what brings us here other than the fact that Heather Angel was in Premature Burial and in this one film as well?
Well, I think Hitchcock he's one of those directors that you don't even need to have seen any of his films to also know so much about him. He is one of the few directors that reaches that kind of critical mass in culture, just in terms of, like, whether it's his unmistakable caricature, whether it's, you know, certain sequences from his films, the music of Bernard Herrmann, Saul Bass's title sequences. These are things and elements of his work have basically been digested and circulated through culture as an incredible influence. And yet, Hitchcock is also something of a problem for film analysis, especially through the lens of auteur studies. And we've brought that up many times before. If it's your first time, all you got to know is that some people think that the best films in the world are made by singular visionaries that control as many elements of the filmmaking process as possible. They create very personal, very immediately identifiable works. And the thing is, I mean, Hitchcock certainly is an identifiable director, maybe more so than anyone else I can name. You always know when you're watching a Hitchcock film. And yet, he did not write most of his scripts. I believe he only wrote one screenplay for a film that he made, and that was a silent black and white film back in England called The Ring. It's terrible. Not all movies about wrestling make me interested. But yes, he would have periods where he would collaborate with the same few people. He got a couple good years out of Cary Grant, and then he disappeared, so then he got a couple good years out of Jimmy Stewart, and he just sort of picks and chooses, has these weird little fits and starts. He has a run of making very morbid crime films, followed by like a run of high gothic melodrama. There's a lot of Hitchcock that can't just be reduced to a simple explanation. You know, it's not like we can look at him and say, well, he was an anti-colonialist filmmaker, or he was a radical Marxist filmmaker. Hitchcock was a lot of things, and they don't always so nicely gel. But the other thing is, Hitchcock, we remember him for the big ones, but he also made, I believe, 50 films in the course of his career. Some of them were silent, some of them were in sound, some in black and white, some in color, some of them in England, some in America. He even remade his own films at various points, and there's a lot that poses a real problem to what we normally assume when we talk about auteurs. And I think that inability to square up really might be the most Hitchcockian impulse of all. But I think looking at Suspicion, well, first off, we got to see Cary Grant when he was young and handsome, so that's always a plus. But I think it's also a very interesting exercise. 'Cause this whole period, you know, pretty much from here to Rope, Hitchcock is a bit more experimental as a storyteller than he's often given credit for. And in the case of Suspicion, it's a fairly simple setup, but the film becomes an exercise in how long can we sustain textual ambiguity. Like, do we necessarily have to resolve narratives? And I mean, like, to think of recent examples, Take Shelter is a good example, because the film hinges on, is Michael Shannon crazy, or crazier than Michael Shannon usually is, or is he the only guy who really knows what's going on? Black Swan. Is Natalie Portman crazy, or is the world making her crazy? And my biggest complaint about all of them is that they build and build this either-or ambiguity, and then in the last 2 minutes, the film like slaps its hand down on the table and says, no, it's that one. Suspicion is an interesting counterpoint to that, happening like 70 years before these other films were made. So I loved it the first time I saw it, and I figured, well, I don't have any better ideas, because otherwise we're going to follow Ray Milland everywhere, or we're going to see another Shakespeare adaptation, only this one starring Alfred from Batman. So, Dave, let me ask you, what is your experience with Hitchcock?
I think to come back to this point about the idea of Hitchcock is this omnipresent and very easily identifiable figure, you know, when you're a young film fan, his is one of those names you're going to come across very soon and very quickly, and for pretty much the most part, it is a well-deserved reputation. And, you know, I remember, you know, as a teenager getting my hands on things like the Warner box set of Hitchcock films, or in trying to track down and rent some of his other works at the local video store. And, you know, I had a pretty good sense of Hitchcock's filmography prior to even ending up at university itself. And again, I really, really respect him as a filmmaker. I really love a good chunk of his work. Not everything is 100% great, but I would say that it's one of those cases where even the least Hitchcock movie that you can think of usually has something of interest to it or something that's worthwhile and notable, including things such as, yeah, Frenzy, which is probably one of the ones that a lot of people look down upon, I think is a rather fascinating movie and pretty far removed from what we're going to be discussing here today, though, and gets into a whole nother kettle of fish. But yeah, I mean, he's made, I think, some amazing films such as Shadow of a Doubt, North by Northwest. Rope is amazing for those who haven't seen it, without question. Lifeboat is a really another fascinating one that I think gets overlooked quite often. But this is also a guy who made Topaz, which on the late great Cinema Chase, me and James discussed that one. And
oh, you guys actually sat through Topaz? It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's not his best work, not by a long shot. But yeah, so I mean, Hitchcock is somebody I have a lot of admiration for. But like, I mean, it's certainly not without, you know, its highs and lows. And I think coming to Suspicion itself, to tip my hat a little bit, it's certainly not a low, but it's definitely not a high point either. It's a film that's firmly in the middle of the Hitchcock filmography, as quality-wise, at least as
though
far as I'm concerned.
Given the themes of the film, it seems somewhat appropriate that this film ends up kind of in the middle. But yeah, I mean, it's easy to get overshadowed when not only do you make films that are still as widely celebrated as something like Psycho or North by Northwest, but when you especially look at this in the context of his later work, you know, you have these dazzling set pieces like the climax of North by Northwest on Mount Rushmore, or of course the shower scene, or the Mrs. Bates reveal in Psycho. Like, he's a filmmaker that constructs very big moments. And yet, I think one of the central difficulties, though, is that, you know, Hitchcock started making films almost a century ago. And when we think about that, and when we think about, you know, how discursively, like, we've taken up his mantle, and how, like, probably more than any other director, like, Hitchcock is a director that can inspire, like, debates and conversations about film style between people who have absolutely no interest and never will open up a film textbook. I think that's very cool in a lot of ways. But I think it's also very difficult because it's hard to take his films as individual texts. And I think there's a tendency to only be able to read any of his films through his work as a whole. And I guess as a challenge for us, can we look at the film itself? I guess we're about to find out. But so, as we said, Suspicion gets released in 1941, obviously directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Its production background is kind of interesting, because the year previously, Hitchcock made Rebecca, his adaptation of Daphne du Maurier's novel, and he's making another adaptation in similar territory of high melodrama. Except this is based off a novel called Before the Fact by Francis Iles. It was apparently a pen name for Anthony Berkeley Cox, according to your notes, and I don't know who that is. But, so, apparently there's enough interest in this script that RKO had a script commissioned by Nathaniel West, who, I only point that out because Day of the Locust is one of my favorite novels, and if we do get a chance to watch John Schlesinger's film version of that, you know, we're taking it. I don't care what I have to steamroll out of the way. But Wes makes a script, but then Hitchcock gets hired, and then suddenly RKO turns around and says, oh yeah, we won't be needing you anymore, because it turns out when Hitchcock came aboard, he already had a script that was compiled by his longtime muse and collaborator, Alma Reville, as well as Samson Raphaelson and Joan Harrison. So, at heart, the script and the book are telling the same story, where a young woman who is somewhat affluent in a noble family, high society, as they used to say, she ends up getting entangled with a charming gadflyish rogue. And, you know, it's the standard meet-cute stuff. He's a bit of a bad boy, bit of a rebel. But eventually, more and more things start happening, and it becomes unmistakably clear that he might be trying to murder her for her money. And if that isn't a melodrama setup, I don't know what is. And I think that also speaks to Hitchcock's tendency to really, like, you have people like Godard that are really trying to deconstruct film style and film text and make everything an argument about Marxism. Whereas Hitchcock as a filmmaker, I always thought was much more contained. Like, first and foremost, he struck me as somebody who wanted to tell stories. So this movie comes off as fairly pulpy, and in a lot of respects, it is. However, there's a pretty big change that I think we'll get into as we don't totally spoil the movie before we even talk about it. But in that regard, the two of them are linked. So in this case, we have Joan Fontaine, who plays Lena, the socialite, who meets Johnny Asgarth, played by Cary Grant in fine 1940s form. And a chance meeting on the train ends up having them become involved with one another. And, yeah, wherever it's going from there, though, it's probably not going anywhere good. Or is it? Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess this is a good point to say, A, spoilers ahead, folks, as usual. We will spoil the heck out of anything and everything. But the film... To come back, I guess, maybe to the book there for one second before we go there, because it's interesting that you say there's one significant change, but there's, I would say, really two, because you're hinting towards the end of it, the thing. But the key thing about the book, that I, from everything I've read about it, certainly I haven't read the book itself in prep for this, is the fact that it's a film that is explicitly about a terrible marriage, for the most part, in the sense that,
wrong.
You know... Yeah, in which it's a follows a, you know, a woman who, in the case of the film, you know, and we'll get into this in a second, is out of almost a fear of being considered an old maid who never gets married, decides to, you know, basically take up with this individual and fall in love and go forth. And in the case of the book, it becomes very readily apparent that Johnny is, by all accounts, a complete scumbag over time, as we discover. In the case of the film, yeah, she goes for, she has this counter, and she seems very hesitant when, as Joan Fontaine plays it early on with Johnny, where it's like, she's attracted to him, but she's also very much firmly establishing boundaries, throughout this. And it's only upon overhearing her parents talk about the fact that, well, maybe she's just never going to get married, you know, and that's just the way it's going to be. That almost becomes a challenge for her, as she sees. She's almost takes offense to the notion, and, you know, in probably a moment of poor decision-making, ends up saying, yeah, I'm going to marry this guy. And the film goes, sir, am I wrong in any of that, Andrew?
You're not. And, I mean, I think in the case of the film, it does sort of, it gives it a certain degree of plausibility. Because there's a point about midway through where you're kind of like, well, why would anybody put up with Johnny's BS, whatever his motives are? But, I mean, the fact that unmarried women, I mean, even in this day and age, face a tremendous amount of social pressure. And there's the idea that, well, if you haven't started a family by 30, I mean, no one's ever going to want to, because they're all going to think there's a reason why you haven't found yourself a beau yet. And, I mean, that just becomes further and further magnified through the lens of 1940s and, like, the last vestiges of the English class system. So, I mean, it makes sense there, but, again, like, it allows this film to almost be a commentary more than just about this marriage, but marriage itself. Yeah. I'm kind of okay with being a bachelor, having seen this, but, yeah, so it's... The film... I guess what, as we're alluding to, the film is really a balance of tensions, because with everything that happens, Lena nor the audience can really make up their minds whether Johnny is just a guy who makes very poor decisions, and, you know, he's carefree, he's a gadfly, you know, he's one of those cats that seems preternaturally incapable of being accountable for anything. But as things add up and it becomes easier and easier to realize, well, he's not the dashing suitor that we thought he would be. Then it's a question of, well, but does that mean he's capable of murdering people either? And I mean, like, sorry, go ahead.
No. I was going to say, and I think that's one of the crux of the change from the book to the film, is that in the case of the book, I mean, they very explicitly outline just how scummy Johnny is over the course of the text. There's all sorts of things that get dropped from the film version, likely due to both a combination of the production code and the idea that we're not going to make Cary Grant that scummy on screen, because there are things such as the fact that Johnny has multiple affairs. A child born of the maid that works in the household. Again, the fact that, you know, he... I think it's very explicit that he does engineer a situation for one person to die early on in the book that isn't where there's no ambiguity of that. And, you know, Hitchcock takes a very different approach in the sense that the entire film is centered around this idea of, okay, you have all the reasons in the world to know that this guy is creepy and, you know, clearly a serial liar, a gambler, and a thief. But yeah, as you note, Andrew, does that end up equating to he's a murderer? And the film plays that ambiguity throughout its entire running time, which, again, is not an easy thing to do going through it, to say the least. Because, I mean, certainly a lot of film is built around the notion of at least Hollywood filmmaking is built around having clear notions and understanding as to what is character motivation, what characters are doing, and why are they doing it.
Yeah, that's one of the cornerstones of what we call the classic Hollywood style, right? I mean, look at Casablanca, for instance, and compare it to this one. You know, it's always moving forward, and everybody's motivations are always clear. The end goal is always clear. And, I mean, this is a film that really, really, really commits to playing around in the gray area.
Yeah, absolutely. And it creates a sort of interesting, you know, situation where the film is pretty much told from the point of view of Lena all throughout the film. And we always are experiencing, even though, you know, Cary Grant is arguably the bigger star at this point, and, you know, the entire focus of the film, we're always experiencing him as a remove, which is why I kind of find it fascinating that at one point Hitchcock's preferred title for this film was supposed to be Johnny, above and beyond anything else, because it doesn't feel like that's really what the movie is about as far as it being a character study, necessarily.
I mean, the whole reason that the plot works is because we're denied that interiority for Johnny, that our understanding only comes from what we see and what Lena sees, and especially when the film starts, like, drawing us into her subjectivity. I think that becomes really interesting because, yeah, she can't make up her mind, and transitively, neither can we. But I think... I know I said I'd try and resist this, but I think it's pertinent here that Hitchcock, there's one book where it's an extended interview of him and director Francois Truffaut, and I remember one passage where Hitchcock says he sees himself first and foremost as a suspense filmmaker. And this comes out maybe 20 years after this film does, but I think that's very telling, and as he articulates it, you know, a thriller film or a film that hinges on surprise. He says there's a lovely dinner party being held, and then all of a sudden a bomb goes off under the table that nobody knew was there. That's a shock. That's a surprise. But the difference is suspense would be showing that dinner party, slowly panning below the table and showing a ticking bomb, and then cross-cutting between shots of the bomb and everybody just enjoying their creme brulee. But suspicion doesn't, like, it actually is the exception to that rule, because, you know, like, Psycho, for instance, we know pretty early on that Mother, at least we think it's Mother, is killing people, and that Norman is involved with something unsavory. You know, in North by Northwest, we learn very early about all the inner workings of the mistaken identity plot. In Suspicion, we are denied that information. And in fact, we're never really given it, even by the film's conclusion. And I find that very unlike a lot of his other works.
It is. And it begs the question, and again, which makes it probably far more experimental in the grand scheme of things. But the question is, ultimately, does that experiment work here? And I think this brings us to the crux of the question, which brings us to, which is the conclusion of the film. And again, folks, we're going to spoil things. There's no way to get around it. And we're going to backtrack and we'll talk about how Hitchcock sort of achieves the ambiguity throughout the film leading up to this point. But I think we kind of have to hit the elephant in the room before we can go anywhere else here. So did you want to explain how this film concludes, Andrew?
Okay, well, after a series of escalations and Lena getting concrete proof that, no, Johnny is actually, he has lied to her, he's sold antique furniture, he's been actively wishing for her father's death in the hope of getting money, he is embezzled from an old friend, he may have had something to do with another friend's unfortunate death, the two of them decide that they are going to take a drive, and that leads to probably, like, the last 10 minutes of this film are probably the most iconic, but it concludes with them driving on a mountain road, like, winding through the hills. Johnny accelerates, takes a hairpin turn, and the door flies open. And then we realize, oh, wait, despite all the mise-en-scene, he's not trying to push her out of the vehicle. Instead, they pull over, and he calmly explains that he feels like he's a bad husband because he screwed everything up, and that he's going to take her to her mother's house, and then he's going to kill himself. And as a result of that, Lena basically takes it as face value and forgives him, and they agree that they're going to face all the challenges of the future together. So they get back in the car. There is a shot of Johnny draping his arm around her, and then suddenly we cut back to the car on the road as it drives into the horizon. The end. So there's somewhat of a debate over how we're supposed to read this ending. And indeed, like in our notes for the show, you and I ended up having that same debate because some people, all right, history says that RKO Studios forced Hitchcock to come up with a different ending than the book, because as I understand the book, Lena realizes that Johnny is a murderer and that he's trying to kill her. And she just kind of accepts that. So she ends up allowing herself to get poisoned, but she writes a letter explaining everything that happened and basically, like, you know, confessing all of Johnny's crimes, I think to her mother, to the police or something. Johnny mails the letter, and that's where it ends.
That was certainly the scripted ending of, at one point, for the film version, which I think the book maybe plays it a little bit differently, but ostensibly it's the same general idea for both in this instance.
And I mean, that works on some levels because, I mean, in more overt terms, like if we're going to see this film as a commentary on marriage and the social pressures that underpin it, I mean, a lot of this film can be understood in terms of, like, you know when you have that one friend that's dating somebody that just really isn't good for them, but, you know, the dude that gets way too drunk at events and starts getting obnoxious, and they're always making excuses or rationalizing why, well, it's just a quirk of his. And I would know because I've been that partner to some people. But, like, this film, I think what's interesting about it is that, you know, even from the get-go, we're introduced to Johnny by him coming into Lena's train car. You know, he's well-dressed, he's articulate, somewhat charming, and no sooner can we form a positive opinion than the coachman comes in, demands to see Johnny's ticket, and when he doesn't have one, he ends up hitting Lena up for 10 quid so he can stay on the train. So, I mean, that's one of those things where you groan, roll your eyes, and make a concession for this interesting stranger. And as the film goes on, like, things get more and more extreme, but it's really a continuation of that impulse to be like, oh, that's just the way they are. And I think in the context of this quote-unquote original ending, like, that's it taken to the logical extreme, where it's like, well, I'm going to let you kill me, but that's okay, because that's just how my husband is.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, it's a fitting ending for this film, because, I mean, what we should back up and note is that probably the point at which this film changes from ostensibly what the original ending was supposed to be is there's an iconic sequence, which I would say is probably the most famed image or scene in the entire movie.
Oh, yes.
Which is what ends up happening is because most of the film, there isn't a lot of what would we consider action per se, because it's a lot of characters talking and misunderstandings and, you know, people meeting up and discussing things and information being revealed that way. There's a dinner party where a local mystery writer, a sort of, I guess, you know, he would ostensibly be kind of like a version of Agatha Christie, as it were.
Yeah, sort of a writer local of pot boilers.
Yeah, who, you know, Johnny and Lena are part of a dinner with the writer's brother and mystery guest woman who is apparently was a very big problem for the production code when they were originally putting a lot of stuff, the screenplay through, as far as that character's concerned. We'll get to that later on. But there ends up being this discussion about the idea of an untraceable poison that could, you know, a person could use to kill someone and get away with it. And as we end up discovering later on, Johnny ends up getting a hold of that secret.
What are the odds?
Yeah. And lo and behold, this leads to a sequence where Lena, who's fallen somewhat ill and is resting in bed, Johnny comes up in a rather sinister manner with this glass of milk, which, as you know, lit, looks like it's glowing, as he makes his way up the stairs in this very expressionistic shadow cast across the entire room and brings it to her bed. And yeah,
they dim the lights, and then the high contrast of the black and white really comes out. Anecdotally, I've heard that they actually did some kind of a setup where they placed, like, a fluorescent light bulb, like, right behind the glass to give it that eerie glow to it, because it's very distinctive, and it's a really cool sequence.
Absolutely. And, you know, supposedly what was supposed to happen is you'd see Lena finish writing the letter when he gets into the room and ask him to mail it, and then, you know, she would drink it, knowing that it's likely poison, and yeah, she would pass away. That's not what ends up happening, because the sequence ends with him coming in the room. He puts the milk on the end table beside the bed there, and, you know, wishes her a good night. And we then suddenly dissolve to the next morning, where the glass sits untouched, which leads to the sequence of Lena packing to go to her mother's, which offends Johnny, and then leads to the rest of the sequence that you discussed, Andrew, in terms of what is supposedly the climax of this film.
But what if Johnny's whole plan was that she didn't drink the milk and then suffer from a lifetime of osteoporosis?
That would be a far different and more confusing movie than I think anybody would have anticipated from Hitchcock.
He's playing the long game on this one.
Yeah, the notorious 17-hour cut of Suspicion that we never got to see. Take that, greed. But no, I think here's the thing. It's going to come down to this. The ending of this movie is, the entire film is built around ultimately this idea of the sustained uncertainty throughout. And Hitchcock handles it masterfully. And we'll go through into why how he does that so well through the majority of it. Impeccably well. But ultimately, the film builds to a point where you kind of have to provide an answer, one way or the other, I find. And instead, the climax we get is a climax where Hitchcock seems to try to have it both ways, where he gives the studio the happy ending where it turns out Johnny isn't a killer, and therefore Cary Grant isn't a killer, and, you know, everything looks like it's going to have this happy ending, but he codes it in such a way that it really is just a repeat of things we've seen throughout the film. Johnny comes up with this whole explanation as to, for all the things that Lena's been wondering about, even though it's one of the first things established early on in this movie is the idea that Johnny's a quick on his feet liar. And the film doesn't provide any additional textual evidence to suggest that anything Johnny is saying in the climax of this movie is any more truthful than we've seen in any of the preceding scenes. So ultimately, what we are left with is just another scene of Lena mistakenly believing everything's okay again.
And let me stop you there, David, because watching it this time, I did notice, I think, something that may be a crucial change in how we read the ending. Because Johnny is the one, he talks a lot, he's very verbose, and he has an answer for everything. In that final sequence, though, he says a little bit, like, he intimates that, well, I'll drop you off at your mother's, and then you'll never have to worry about me anymore. And then he looks all sullen and downtrodden. And then it's Lena who basically says the explanation out loud. Because then she turns and says, oh, Johnny, you're going to go kill yourself with that poison you've been looking up. And, like, she basically lays out the scenario for him. And watching Grant's performance there, like, he's flat, but then he kind of, like, makes a face, like, a side eye. Like, wait, what? Oh, yeah, that's what I was doing. And it's very subtle. Like, it's not like he's winking at the audience or holding up a sign that says, like, can you believe how dumb people are? But I feel like that's just one of the ways where the ending is coded where, okay, I think you're right. The studio mandated that they have a happier ending because, well, they have Cary Grant under contract, and people might not like seeing him in movies if they think he's a murderer. But I think the patness of the ending and how it just ends, and you're right, there is no reason to believe what he's saying now any more than there ever was at any other point in the film. I think that, and again, this is one of those things where I'm like, if you look at it in the context of Hitchcock's work, he really enjoys artificiality and, like, playing around with that. And I feel like there is such a level of artifice in the whole concluding section that I don't think we're supposed to take it at face value.
I don't think we're supposed to take it at face value at all. I agree with you there. But I would say this is the distinction when we look at other films where he does something similar, such as Psycho, or if we're taking, or even Vertigo to a degree. It's the notion that, you know, those films build to what I would say is an ambiguous, endings that are ambiguous, or at least, you know, are sort of undercutting the, you know, positive aspects that are being sort of thrust upon it there, that everything's okay. But they still reach an emotional or an ending that has an affect to it, right, where there is a punch to it. Mm-hmm. And this film doesn't. Yeah, we get the ambiguity, but there's nothing about that ending sequence that really is memorable or really feels like, at least, okay, we've reached a conclusion, per se. It's like, this could just as well be any other scene in this movie, and that's it. And it's just like, the only reason this is the end is because the film just happens to cut off here. And that to me is rather unsatisfying as an ending, because it's one of these cases where, yeah, I appreciate the cleverness of what Hitchcock is doing, but it doesn't it just does not work on the effective register as well. And I think with these kinds of endings, you have to hit both in order to make that work.
I'm inclined to agree with you. And I mean, you brought up a good point talking earlier where the thing is, Johnny's gesture of pulling Lena close, like, I've read entire essays on how that gesture itself, it could be one of romantic conciliation, or it could be a threatening move. Like, he's pulling her close to put her in a chokehold or something like that. But I think really we're left with that image, and that's an image where one is always going to be laced with the other. Because, like, violence towards somebody, you're still, you know, getting very personal with them. But also, romance with another body requires a certain kind of invasiveness as well. And these can't be separated from one another. So while that final shot is interesting, you're right, though, because it doesn't have that impact. We don't see it and suddenly gasp. You know, it doesn't give us, like, that suspense payoff that we normally are accustomed to, not just in Hitchcock's work, but in film in general. Like, it's an ending that makes you go, rather than necessarily, like, feel anything.
Well, and that's it. I mean, it's an ending that feels like, and it's brilliant intellectual contortionism on Hitchcock's part. But, and again, I mean, it's part and parcel of what he's been doing the entire film, but it's just, it feels like we've just had, you know, you're sitting there waiting for the punchline that never comes. And there are ways which conceivably you could do that and make that work as the climax to your film. But this doesn't do it. I really feel, and it's especially telling because, yeah, I think many of Hitchcock's films end on a fabulous note or a real gotcha note there. I mean, the ending of Vertigo is classic for a reason, and it leaves you with many, many problematic elements you have to work out on your own as you're leaving the theater. And this one, it's just sort of like, yeah, that's the case, I guess. I mean, he's probably going to kill her, you know, 2 seconds later. It's too bad we couldn't actually, you know, have that confirmed for us in a way that would feel satisfying. I mean, you know, and I think that's the thing. Like, it almost feels like this is a film that was made 30 years too early. I mean, given that Hitchcock did tend to remake his films, I would almost be curious to see what he would have done had he redone this in, say, 1970 or 1971.
Ooh.
When, you know, he suddenly the production code's gone and he's dealing with the rating system instead. And, you know, again, could conceivably get away with the fact that, yeah, I don't necessarily have to play with having our leading man be inherently likable, or, you know, doesn't have to, you know, I can do some of the stuff which makes him more explicitly a scumbag in this film. And yeah, have an ending that might even be more downbeat than the ending that, you know, ostensibly he originally wanted for the film as well. But,
well, I think the coming back to the title of the film, though, Suspicion, it's not like, you know, it's almost a companion piece to Shadow of a Doubt, though, where it's, I think, the open reading of the ending still works thematically if we think about this film as ultimately a film about relationships. Because at the end of the day, like, we're left with this image that we can't conclude is one or the other. But, like, throughout the film, like, the dilemma is not that Johnny's an awful person. The dilemma is that Johnny might be an awful person. And once that doubt is in Lena's head, it is impossible to get rid of. And even by the ending, like, we see that penultimate shot of the arm going around her. And, like, we're not sure. So it's the whole idea, like, I mean, do you ever lie awake at night and wonder if your partner is a murderer?
I can't say that that's something that has crossed my mind.
Well, hopefully you'll never have to, because, I mean, ordinarily, we don't suspect the people we love of doing horrible things. And even if they don't do them, the moment that we suspect, the damage has been done. Because Lena, once she doubts Johnny, like, that's kind of the turning point in the film as far as its plot goes, and I'll get into why in a moment, but the fact that she doubts him once means that even if she gets over it, she's always going to have that memory of the time that she doubted her husband. And I think that almost becomes a dilemma in itself, but if that ends up being problematized, then I guess really what the film is saying is that it's better to just trust people even though you shouldn't. So then it becomes a bit more messy and, like, difficult to unpack. But we got to remember that Lena isn't totally, totally incapable, and she's not totally stupid either. Because about halfway through the film, it's around the time that the chairs get sold, and certainly crystallizes when she meets with an old friend of Johnny's who they were going to be in business together. And then she finds out that he fired Johnny and might bring charges because he embezzled all of his money. Like, from that point onward, Lena ain't having it. She begins to actively suspect. She no longer believes him. She pulls away. All the things that come with the loss of trust. But that's also the moment where the character of Beaky, played by Nigel Bruce, gets introduced into the film. And he's Johnny's, like, a lifelong chum, and he's basically ridiculous. Like, he's the film's comic relief, but, I mean, thematically, I think it's very interesting that he shows up and, like, he makes as many excuses for Johnny's behavior as Lena does. Like, even when Johnny's talking about his new business proposal, like, Beaky's just, oh, I've heard that one before. What he really means is you spend all afternoon at the track. but that's okay. That's why we love you, Johnny. And, like, it gets more and more absurd, the excuses that Beaky makes for him. And I think it's almost like an amplified version of how Lena was in the first half of the film. But I think now that she no longer has ultimate faith in Johnny, like, Beaky shows up to just highlight how absurd that rationalizing process is.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, Nigel Bruce's performance is absolutely delightful. I think if our listeners know him from anything else, he was probably most famous for playing Dr. John Watson in the series of Sherlock Holmes films with Basil Rathbone. You're absolutely right. And I love the scenes when he shows up, because the thing about Beaky is he never quite puts it together, the fact that he seems to look at Lena and assume that she's on the same wavelength as him when it comes to Johnny, and the idea that, oh, we all know he's basically a con man, but we love him because of that. And it never registers to him that she's the one being conned in the course of this. And it becomes fascinating later on when, you know, she realizes that Johnny's probably about to take him for all he's worth. She tries everything in her power to warn him about that, without, you know, basically upsetting her husband as she sees it, as best she can. And it's fascinating to sort of try and figure out, you know, why Lena accepts that notion of sticking with Johnny regardless over the same. Because on one hand, the film sort of paints it as a thing where she does indeed love him. But it also brings it back to the question of, does she even understand what that concept means? Because, again, as the film really goes out of its way to paint throughout the early half of this movie, this is not a marriage built necessarily upon romance. It is really built on impulse and, you know, wanting to have a certain, you know, change in your life, regardless of whether this version of it is going to be of benefit to you. Well, and
because Lena is very much coded, you know, Joan Fontaine is a beautiful woman, but she is very dressed down here. It's kind of like, you know, the first half of a movie, like She's All That pre-makeover, where she just wears the blouses, has her hair done up. She's very quiet and mousy. And like, yeah, the idea of Johnny entering her life, not only is that a way to get her parents off her back about marriage, but he's also exciting. He shapes it up. And Johnny clearly needs Lena, because how else is he going to pay for his train tickets?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, again, the sequences that play out about their sort of initial courting there are, on one hand, sort of absurdly hyper accelerated in terms of just how quickly their relationship advances. But at the same time, the way in which Joan Fontaine and Cary Grant play off of one another in those scenes, you buy into it, particularly when it comes to their scene where her and Johnny are speaking to her father's portrait there. And Johnny is basically going, it's like, everything he's telling you right now about me is absolutely true. And the way he's sort of conning her by admitting that, yeah, I am a bit of a scoundrel right off the bat. This notion of, you know, mixing the lies with the truth in order to get what he wants out of this is, you know, it's expertly done. And you can see why she would buy into it at first very well. It's just the film, it struggles the further and further goes on with the notion of, well, why does she keep buying into it going forward? And again, on one hand, I almost feel like it's the question of, I would imagine in the book there's almost a sense of resignation that's probably absent from the film version because of the fact that, A, the book apparently plays out over the course of 10 years, as opposed to this film, which plays over, like, the course of, what, 3 months?
A solid weekend.
something like that. It's certainly not 10 years, although I would have loved to have seen them start throwing Cary Grant in old age makeup and just see how that turned out. There's no sense of, you know, there's not a resignation on her part, and you never get the strong feeling that she really loves Johnny. So I think that unbalances the film a bit as well going forward. And almost all of these issues end up leaning back into the script as well, which, as cleverly as it is constructed, and there's tons of great stuff there. I mean, this is not a shoddy screenplay by any stretch of the imagination. There's just something that isn't quite clicking into place for this movie to make it work as a cohesive whole.
Well, yeah, because Joan Fontaine as Lena, like, she's given a character that is reserved and soft-spoken, so she doesn't really have a big bravura moment, which is funny because she ended up winning the Oscar for Best Actress for her role in this film. And, you know, she carries herself well. We buy her plight and we buy her struggle, even if we think that she probably should have given up maybe 10 minutes earlier. But by that same token, though, Cary Grant as Johnny, like, he plays the role, like, within the narrowest confines possible, because he has to be charming enough that he can dupe Lena into believing everything he says, but he can't be so charming that the audience assumes he just means the best and is misunderstood. So he has this very narrow space where you have to be just charming enough, but not too much so. And I think he hits that really well. The problem is, it's just, you know, and I think as we've said earlier, the problem is, like, the relationship itself has no real spark to it. There's no real chemistry, so even if it's a happy ending and no one's trying to kill anybody, well, they drive off into the sunset to a terrible marriage. You know, it's like the ending of This Is 40, only with a bit more arsenic.
Well, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And that's the struggle with this film. And what's interesting is this film comes out a year after Hitchcock and Joan Fontaine's previous collaboration, which is Rebecca, which was made under the guidance of David O. Selznick. And by guidance, I mean basically the guy Hitchcock was butting heads with the entire time. But that film is one of Hitchcock's best movies, and it works so much better, even though it's covering some of the same thematic ground, in the sense that Joan Fontaine is playing a woman who falls in love with a man and marries him, even though there are some possible darker aspects to him that she's not aware. But again, in the sense, because Rebecca doesn't have that sort of exercise element to it, where it does seem like Hitchcock's trying to see, well, how long can I sustain, you know, the uncertainty on their part? You know, Rebecca is able to work as a more streamlined and, you know, definitive work in terms of what it's trying to do and how it's trying to achieve it, and ultimately hitting the points it wants to hit. I mean, I know Hitchcock was never as fond of it as others, but I mean, again, that kind of enforced structure he's having to play within on that film, I think, really ends up benefiting him there and benefits the film as a whole. And it's still an incredibly complicated, nuanced work.
And stylistically, overall, Rebecca, I would say, is a lot more distinctive than most of what happens in Suspicion. So even when like the script or the performances may be lacking in some areas, like you have that incredibly gothic set design, you have all these really high angle camera shots, like, the film is high melodrama, and as a result, like, it's almost expressionistic because every aspect of the film frame seems to be loaded with thematic meaning. And you compare that to this, and, well, we have a similar plot trapping of a woman who finds herself rushing into marriage and finding herself dispossessed. But I feel like it's only in, like, maybe the final half hour of the film that Suspicion really does anything significant with film style. That's not to say that it's, you know, an ugly film or it's poorly composed. It doesn't have those, like, standout moments until Lena begins to doubt Johnny, and we as the viewer are also drawn into her subjectivity.
Yeah, I would agree with that to an extent. And I think, certainly Suspicion is far more of a slow burn movie in that regard. I would say one area where it does sort of, I don't want to say exceed Rebecca, but proves it maybe a bit more interesting, is in terms of its editing. Because there is a way in which this film plays with, you know, sort of scenes that begin in ways that you don't necessarily anticipate, including, for example, I think one of the most notorious shots of the film, which is Johnny and Lena on the hillside, mm-hmm. On church. Because the way in which that sequence begins, typically the editing of a scene would have brought it in, you know, right as they're walking up the hill and then everything goes through. Instead, we cut right into the midst of which is either a scene of Johnny either trying to, you know, murder Lena, sexually assault her, or as it goes on, to do exactly what he claims he was trying to do.
Yeah, trying to fix her hair. Yeah, we get that, like, dissolved shot, and then it cuts to them in high wind, like, struggling with one another. And it's really jarring. And I think even more so, because, like, this is our first... You know, on the train, we get the indicator that Johnny is, you know, that he's kind of a lowlife. This is our first indicator that he might be dangerous. And I think it's really significant that, you know, the other shots, like, were kind of invited to misread the situation alongside Lena. Here, the audience is cut off from that. Like, we only see the aftermath, so we don't know how it began. We join it in the middle of what could be a battle for life or death, or it could just be, like, a lot of fussing about somebody's hairdo.
No, absolutely. And, I mean, it's really probably one of the most striking scenes in the entire film because of that. But I think I cut you off there. You're about to jump in with something.
Well, I mean, that just it happens right in the middle of the meet cute. So even when things are good, they are still very much underscored with the threat of harm. And, you know, it's weird, though, because, like, we kind of forget that as viewers to an extent that, oh, one of the first implications of this film is that Johnny might be a rapist. But I think, yeah, as the film goes on, though, we are drawn much more into Lena's own subjectivity. Like, the scene where she's checking out the cliffside because she thinks Johnny might be trying to kill Beaky there, and, like, we get those rapid close-ups on her face and sort of her looking out onto the ocean and cutting back and forth. Certainly when she's playing Scrabble, or whatever the old-timey equivalent of it was.
Oh, anagrams.
Anagrams, yes. And Johnny and Beaky, they're talking about taking a trip together, and she looks down and realizes that she spelled out the word murder in front of her. But because, again, the use of the close-ups on characters' faces and then close-ups on objects, it really destabilizes any sense of whether what's happening is objective or subjective. Even the, like, glowing neon glass of milk, like, that happens while Lena is in bed because she's basically having a nervous breakdown. And then we see, like, a series of shots that stylistically is kind of at odds with the rest of the film because there's such a heavy use of shadow there and the way it's stylized. Like, this is one of those things where we see it, but we can't, we eventually can't even be certain that the film is showing us reality. So in a way, like, film style is used in the pursuit of causing us to distrust the film the same way that Lena grows distrustful of Johnny.
No, absolutely. And, you know, again, it's all magnificent, you know, material. I just wish ultimately it built to something, you know, that, you know, brought it all together in a more cohesive fashion, as it were. And I think it's interesting, again, compared to the film we discussed last week, Premature Burial, where you and I sort of had disagreements about the ending of that film as well, in terms of how pat it was, and, you know, whether it sort of was unsatisfying or not. And I think the difference is that in the case of this film, there is so much going on in this film, and Hitchcock is clearly aiming so much higher in terms of what he's trying to achieve that it's hard not to be let down by what he, how the film doesn't really stick the landing, as it were, in a way. Whereas, you know, with Premature Burial, you know, as much as I love it, I'm firmly, you know, Corman has a very, you know, firm vision of what he's going to do, and it's, he's not aiming nearly as high in what he's setting out to achieve, either thematically or visually, as Hitchcock is trying to here.
But. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I realized after we had viewed the film for this week, I'm like, I almost feel like, aside from the ending, though, there's so little to talk about with this film. Because, I mean, we sort of described this as almost like a project film, but I think that's pretty apt, because really the central concern is, can we sustain ambiguity across, like, an hour and 50 minutes of viewing time? The same way that Rope... you know, practical limitations meant that they couldn't truly achieve this. But the crux of Rope is that the whole film is presented as if it's one unbroken take. And, you know, so the thing is, like, okay, so once you evaluate the experiment, it's like, well, what's really left? And I agree with you, because generally I like when films sustain ambiguity, but because the film is neither giving us, like, that pull the rug out from under you moment, but it's also not doing something like the ending of Blade Runner, where it gives an impactful implication that completely destabilizes everything we've thought about earlier. Like, the problem is, yeah, you're right. The ending just sort of repeats everything that happened before.
No, exactly. And it's so hard to look at that as a satisfying conclusion when, you know, you've really brought the viewers to the point where it ultimately is, you know, answer the question or don't answer the question. Don't give us this thing. And I mean, ultimately, you know, I'm happy that Hitchcock, again, doesn't end up... I'm happy that he's still trying to remain playful as he can with that. It just feels, and, you know, doesn't give us the completely phony, schmaltzy happy ending without any questions left. Because, you know, it'd be just like all of a sudden Beaky turns up and, you know, he was behind all the mysterious deaths the entire time. You know.
Well, I think there's the capacity for an interesting reversal as well. Because watching it this time, kind of, there's probably the big emotional moment for Joan Fontaine here is that she's had enough with Johnny and she sits down and writes a letter where she basically says, you know, I hate you, let's get divorced. But then she rips it up and she's crying and looking out the window and it's raining and it's dark and Johnny comes in and he sees her upset and, you know, he asks, oh, you've heard the news then. Now, she misunderstands because she thinks that he's talking about, oh, you heard that I embezzled from my business partner and might go to prison. But he's also misreading her because he thinks that she's already heard the news he's bringing that her father has passed away. So in that moment, they both misunderstand one another. I'm like, they're just unable to actually understand what the other one is saying. And I think there could be a lot more productive material there, especially if, you know, as I suggested, this film really is about relationships deep down. If they did more about Johnny misreading Lena or her realizing that she can be duplicitous as well. Or, I mean, I know it wouldn't fly in like pre-Code era, but like, you know, what if at the end it turns out that Lena actually was, she kills Johnny? Because then, all of a sudden, she'd have all the sympathy of the town, and they'd never bother her about getting married ever again. But, like, there are a lot of ways you can go while keeping it interesting and not just being everything's okay. And, you know, I don't know. Like, normally I love it when a film doesn't resolve its ambiguity, but there's something that just feels off about it in this case.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, it's not... It feels like we're coming down hard on this movie, and the thing is, I would still recommend somebody watch Suspicion.
Yeah, I mean, I really like this movie. It's just in analyzing it, it sounds like we don't.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just the thing, it's where it's like, it's not the most satisfying Hitchcock film, but there's still tons of stuff going on there that's well worth exploring. And again, you get entertaining things such as, you know, Cary Grant, gets to walk in and steal pretty much every scene he's in throughout the film. Even the early stuff where, you know, he's basically conning his way into the party ball and stuff like that is just kind of delightful. And the way, even little scenes such as the reading of the will, of Lena's father's will, mm-hmm. where it turns out what the father does, he's left the portrait of himself to Johnny and Lena, and you just see Johnny go into the other room with a stiff drink, wanders over to that portrait and goes, "You win, old man," and just takes a sip. That is so delightful and charming and darkly funny at the same time that it's like, yeah, I mean, this film is very easy to enjoy while you're watching it. And, you know, that's, again, in taken in on its own, that's a really, you know, excellent quality that I think a lot of films wish they could strive for. It's just, you get the feeling this could be more significant than it is. And, you know, it's hard not to feel slightly disappointed about that at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that also kind of owes to, again, the weirdness. Because, like, it's impossible. I mean, it's difficult in the first place to assign authorial intent, you know? 101 version, ever since Roland Barthes wrote Death of the Author, like, meaning in a text, it's not just what the director wanted to do. It's the interchange between, you know, the text itself, the creator, the audience, all these other factors. But I feel like it would almost be simpler if Hitchcock had written the script as well, because then it would be like, well, no, see, this is how we're supposed to read it. And, like, ultimately, the film is so good at destabilizing any concrete position that we're kind of left floating in the middle. And that even goes towards reading this film, where there's something that doesn't stick that's hard to articulate, but there's also too many things that are really well done and likable about this film to come down on it. I don't know. Like, I think in a lot of ways, it's a pretty understated film. You know, not a lot happens. There aren't any, like, crazy set pieces, the same way that you'll see in, like, North by Northwest. And, like, the performances of the cast are, I think, pretty good. But aside from, like, Beaky, who doubles down as, like, this buffoon-type character, and Oriel Lee as the writer.
Yes.
Who, you know, I think it's also significant that, like, as the film goes into its concluding section and, like, Lena's paranoia grows and grows, that kind of coincides with her having in-depth discussions with the mystery writer about, well, if I were telling a story, I would have him poison her wine at dinner and things like that. And it's almost like adaptation many years before adaptation, in the sense that, like, I feel like when the writer shows up and starts commenting on how the story should go, like, that's also kind of the point where the film also gets a lot more cliched. And I wonder if that's an accident.
And I honestly don't know. I mean, part of me would almost want to say that it wouldn't be, because Hitchcock seems firmly aware of what the tropes of murder mysteries are. Like, I mean, you come back to things like even Shadow of a Doubt, where you have the lead character's father and his next-door neighbor, you know, discussing these murder magazines and how I would kill you, you know, if I was trying to do something, and sort of, you know, working their way through some of the absurdities and clichés that you get stuck with in these kinds of films, that I would have a hard time believing that Hitchcock wouldn't be aware that of what he's doing. But again, the film ultimately, trying to make any sort of meta commentary, I don't ultimately see what its final point is at the end of the day, because other than sometimes a murder mystery just doesn't have an ending. I honestly don't know what we're supposed to take that commentary as being.
Well, yeah, and like, you can talk about, like, well, you know, Hitchcock as a filmmaker is clearly fascinated with, like, the sinister undercurrents of everyday life, or, like, the evil that lies underneath normalcy. You know, Shadow of a Doubt, Psycho, even The Lodger, which is probably the oldest Hitchcock film that I've seen. It's 1926 or 27, and basically it's similar to Suspicion, only it's silent, and it's about a man who takes a room in a boarding house who may or may not be Jack the Ripper. So I was thinking, like, okay, well, this film is where Hitchcock really starts exploring, like, the dark side of human nature. And I'm like, no, because that both predates this film and gets emphasized in the works that come after. You know, I think this one stands out because, like, it's his most sustained project looking at just that tension. But again, like, yeah, I don't know. Like, I want to recommend this movie, but I also don't know if there's anything singular beyond the fact that it's absolutely committed to staying in the middle, and that Cary Grant is super charming, and Joan Fontaine won an Oscar.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, it's really, in that way, it is, like, it's a middle-of-the-pack Hitchcock film, where, you know, I think it would be a great entry point. If you haven't seen a Hitchcock movie before, you could do far worse than starting here as your beginning point. And certainly you can work your way up to better films like Rebecca, Shadow of a Doubt. Even, you know, what is it? Saboteur. The one about the theater owner who's trying to sabotage Britain, or...
Oh, yeah.
Like,
that's the one
like...
that they played the clip of in Inglourious Basterds, right? I think
so.
Never mind.
Maybe. I honestly can't remember. But, you know, yeah, there are plenty of great Hitchcock films. And, I mean, there are other interesting misfires, or... And I say misfires in the sense that they're still worth watching out there. Like, I mean, you look at something like... Again, Mr. and Mrs. Smith is probably the most radical, not radical film Hitchcock made in terms of how it breaks from everything he's ever done. So that kind of ends up being, you know, it's not great and it's a lesser film than Suspicion. But because it's such a radical break, it's almost more interesting in a way, even if it is a failure. So I don't know.
Well,
I mean,
I think sometimes it's okay to say, I don't know, because I guess... I'd like to summarize with another anecdote. When I was doing graduate studies, I took a seminar on Hitchcock, and this was right around the same time that Richard Allen wrote his book, Hitchcock's Romantic Irony. And again, like, Hitchcock is this problem, because, like, you can't chart out, like, a neat trajectory or, like, you know, oh, Hitchcock started in the studio and then became independent, or any of the normal narratives we use when bracketing a director's work. So what Allen thought is that you can actually explain all of Hitchcock's films under a consistent worldview that is basically a spectrum. And at one point of the spectrum, you have romanticism. That's his more hopeful films. North by Northwest, the ones where the ending almost becomes magic realism. And then at the other end, you have irony, where no one means what they say and nothing is what you think it is. And that's how we account for films like Vertigo and that. But I remember after trying to write a 30-page essay evaluating that book and, you know, assessing its argument in the context of Hitchcock's films, it dawned on me that it's like, what's the point? If we come up with a master theory to explain everything, then it doesn't really tell us much about anything. And that's sort of the difficulty in Hitchcock, because you can't place his films only in relation to his overall body of work, because it's not consistent enough for one to take shape. But there are so many little quirks in that happening in his films that can only be made sensible through Hitchcock's body at large. So, ultimately, trying to read Hitchcock is just like trying to read the ending, where it's a threat and it's romance, and deep down, really, it's just an arm around your shoulder. And I guess it's up to the viewer to decide what one they're seeing and what emotional response they're going to have.
And with that, we're going to turn to hits and pits.
Yeah, wow, Dave. This conversation turned out a lot different than I thought it would.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird one this week where, you know, you'd sit there and think, you know, we'd have about like 7 hours worth of material for discussing Hitchcock, but not really the case this time.
Yeah, I guess if we picked Rear Window, I could have done my Jimmy Stewart impression.
Yeah, as opposed to Cary Grant, God, that was terrible.
Wow.
Yeah. I promise to never do that again, folks.
No, I think you should do it more, especially if people know what we're doing next week. But yes, so David, you were gracious enough to grant me the wheel on this one. So let me ask you, in our patent-pended bumper segment, what are some of the smaller victories and crushing failures of this film? What are your hits?
The way in which we got to this film was through Heather Angel and from Premature Burial. And, you know, she plays, you know, the housemaid for Lena and Johnny in this film, and doesn't get much of a role, but I want to give credit to a very weird little detail that seems like a leftover nod, at the very least a leftover nod to the idea that, you know, Johnny was having an adulterous affair with her that couldn't be done on screen. And that's the scene when Johnny comes back after having, quote-unquote, won $2,000 at the races, which we later find out he embezzled from work, where, you know, he's bought everybody a present. He's got, you know, his wife the chairs back and a couple hats. He got Beaky a new walking stick, which, again, walking sticks. Let's make that a thing again. For one moment, there's one thing where all of a sudden, towards the end of the scene, you discover Johnny bought the maid a, like this fur wraparound that she throws over herself. And again, it's not a major detail, but it is kind of one of those, okay, why was that a thing that happened? Because, I mean, it's nice that, you know, on one hand, he's treating ostensibly his employee well, but, you know, that's kind of an extravagant gift.
Yeah, you buy fur for your mistress, you buy your wife a chair.
It's a weird little touch, and, you know, they never make a big deal about it later on, but kudos here for that weird detail. What about you, Andrew?
On that note, Hitchcock is also notable for being sort of a tongue-in-cheek filmmaker and incorporating a lot of humor into his films in this weird metatextual way that, like, very few other people in the 40s were doing. Because now that I think about it, The Lodger also has this really odd fourth wall breaking gay joke about the main actor. That's the kind of filmmaker Hitchcock is. So little details like that do pop up a lot, and they're usually not entirely by accident. But speaking of humor, I think my biggest hit is I just forgot how incredibly strange it is. The scene where... Actually, it's the same scene where Johnny reveals that he won big on the races, and Lena is all downtrodden because she realizes Johnny lied to her, and Beaky is there. And Nigel Bruce and Cary Grant, when they're together on screen, they go back and forth, and it basically turns into a different film where they just have like the rapid overlapping dialogue finishing each other's sentences. But then they look at Lena and it's like, oh, what's the matter? She seems sad. And then Beaky's idea is, I know, what if I make a duck noise to cheer her up? And he just starts looking at her, making duck noises. And then Cary Grant is just like, no, that's not helping. And then he reaches and starts like stroking her chin and says, okay, what if I did this at the same time? All right, let's try it. And then Nigel Bruce just keeps making duck noises while Cary Grant furrows his brow and starts touching her face. And I'm like, what is even happening right now?
It is a weird scene, and it's interesting how there seems to be this infantilization of Lena at that point with what they're approaching, because they're very much treating her like a child scene.
We didn't even talk about his pet name for her. He doesn't her Lena. He calls her Monkey Face.
Yeah, which is, weird. It does it, like, numerous times. It's not like that happens once or twice. Like, that happens repeatedly throughout this movie, where he calls her that. And, yeah, it really, you know, again, coming back to the notion of relationships and the idea of a sort of power imbalance there, where, you know, Johnny is only ever openly threatening to Lena at one point in this movie, which is basically after she tries to sort of convince Beaky that maybe he should look more closely at the details of this company that Johnny's trying to set up with him. And Johnny, very gruffly or, you know, sternly, you know, lectures her about staying out of his business and that. And that almost seems like it comes out of nowhere, but then you look at how he treats Lena in terms of this, again, childlike behavior where, you know, maybe if we make goofy faces at her, she'll, you know, cheer up. You know, it makes perfect sense that he seems more paternal, how paternalistic he seems in those scenes, and that there's something kind of, you know, I'm not going to say violent, but definitely not even dehumanized. Like, I'm trying to think of the right word, but he's definitely stripping her of her agency by even these sort of more benign touches of his.
Well, it's even more infuriating, like, through 2018 eyes, because Johnny, out of anybody, has absolutely no claim to, like, the hand of the father and sort of, like, that patriarchal power, because he has no money of his own. He has no, like, noble birth or anything like that. Like, he shows up in the film, and from frame one, he is basically a parasite. So, I mean, like, if that's deliberate as a commentary on patriarchy, then well done. But I don't think that's what the film is ultimately trying to do. And given given all the things you can read about Hitchcock, I don't know if that is ever a project he would seriously take on. I mean, people talk about Rear Window and, like, the male gaze and sort of repurposing that. But, I mean, the repurposing comes from how we read it. I think Hitchcock just kind of uses it as is. But that's a whole other argument for another episode.
But I would say that, I mean, certainly while you're right, I don't think Hitchcock himself would ever consider that a project. I mean, this is a film written by Joan Harrison and Alma Reville. So I wouldn't put it necessarily past them to try and sneak something past Hitchcock as well, whether he knows it or not, in terms of what's going on in terms of the gender politics of the film.
That's true. There's also no photograph of Alfred Hitchcock where his eyes are more than halfway open.
This is also true. So, but yes, so yeah, that's a delightful scene. I guess one thing that is also a hit we should probably mention. We noted that one of his longtime collaborators is Bernard Herrmann in terms of music, but that's not who's working on this film, because here we have Franz Waxman, who produces the score, and it's a fine score. Waxman is probably, you know, best known for doing things such as Bride of Frankenstein, and the music for that film. And he comes up with it's a score that can, you know, veers from being sort of sweet and playful to very sinister at the drop of a hat, and he does it well. All throughout. I mean, I'm certainly not going to come out necessarily humming anything from this movie, but, you know, a good score is a good score, and it deserves recognition here.
Mm-hmm. It follows the sort of emotional intensities of the film well, and even in that, like, very bizarre fade in on the possible physical assault early on, like, especially because that's counterpointed to the jaunty music playing seconds earlier. Like, the music does trigger, like, most of the film's strong emotional responses. And I guess in tandem with that, I'd like to list my other hit of Harry Stradling Sr., who did the cinematography for the film, and also shot Streetcar Named Desire. Like, as we've said, a lot of this film is fairly, unspectacular. But at the same time, in the second half of the film, as things ramp up, that's when we get the more stylized shots. And honestly, like, it deserves a hit simply for the whole sequence of Johnny opening the door in the shadow and coming there with a glass of milk and that staircase shot. Like, it's put together incredibly well. I mean, I think it's kind of a shame that even in, like, film analytic texts, like, they'll reduce this film to that one sequence. But that's a testament to just how visually and orally stunning that sequence is.
No, absolutely. I mean, it really is, you know, the showstopper of this film. Which, again, you know, I mean, all the more reason that, you know, that should have been part of the climax. That's neither here nor there. So I guess this brings us to some pits, Andrew. So what do you have for us on that we haven't mentioned, maybe?
Honestly, I don't know. I feel like I've mentioned all of it. I think sometimes the tonal shifting does, like, okay, there's a difference between Johnny doing something terrible and being able to charm his way into forgiveness versus when it sort of happens as a non sequitur, like the duck sequence. It just, and maybe it's because, like, this film doesn't have a consistent tone emerge from it, that it's, like, when there's no consistent tone, it's a lot harder to identify, like, when something works within the sensibility of the film. But at the same time, there are some of those moments where it swings too abruptly, or, like, you know, Lena's willingness to forgive. Again, that could all be part of a point. That could be a commentary on human nature and the things we do for love. But the fact that it's never entirely certain means that, like, I don't know. I think there are some moments where it just comes off as a little bit sillier. The fact that Lena even trusted this cat in the first place is nothing short of a miracle. But I think, yeah, there are aspects where, like, it doesn't stick the tone. And that's really more of a function of even the filmmakers not seeming to know what the tone of this film is supposed to be. What about you, Dave?
I don't know if there's any major thing, and the one I can think of, and it's not really a nitpick, and we sort of mentioned it earlier, the opening of the film where we're supposed to find that Joan Fontaine's Lena is, quote-unquote, you know, at risk of, in scare quotes, at risk of becoming an old maid. That just, when they mention that, it's like, really? That's how we were supposed to read it? Because I know they make her up with the glasses and the hair and the hat early on there, but it never reads that way because it's Joan Fontaine. I mean, she is glamorous as all hell, regardless of what you know they what her costuming is. So it's just sort of like, you know, she, like, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, you have to squint and I'll buy into it, but I mean, come on. It almost makes you question whether maybe we need, again, because I like her performance in this movie. I almost wonder if you did this with somebody who was less movie star.
Because I feel like, I mean, Joan Fontaine clearly can act. She clearly demonstrates, like, a very strong screen presence. But I think maybe she's miscast only in the sense that, like, she can't do all the things she's capable of doing because if she's too impactful within the scene, or she's a little too loud or forthright, then she's no longer playing Lena as she's written. And I feel like, yeah, that's kind of a shame.
Yeah, so, I mean, I know she won the Oscar for this film, and I certainly, you know, nobody's going to take that away from her. We certainly don't have that power, nor would we utilize it, even if we did. But, I mean, yeah, it's hard to look at this as her career best by any stretch of the imagination. I'd be curious to look back and see who she was up against for that award, though, in hindsight, but...
Yeah, or maybe if there were, like, 10 great movies she made in the decade prior that didn't get awards, so this is, like, her training day.
That could be, you know, Scorsese gets The Departed, she gets it for this film, so,
Kudos. More than any other film, I think I've explained all this film's tendencies using references to other movies. So, yeah, I mean, it's one thing to give people a through line, it's another to, write analysis the way that Family Guy writes jokes. But yeah, so any words to wrap up Suspicion with, Dave?
It is available on DVD. You can get your hands on it. And if you weren't already inclined to go see it beforehand, I recommend it. So
there's that. I mean, for like Vertigo, particularly in recent years, I know Sight and Sound has now decided it's the greatest film of all time, according to critics and all that. Like, there are movies like Psycho, there are movies like Vertigo that really stand out. But, I mean, personally, the first time I saw Psycho, I was a kid. I was put off by how boring it all seemed, aside from the big set pieces. I'd say if you're new to Hitchcock, Suspicion is a great starting point. Because it carries on the themes of his larger work, while in a bit more of a palatable form. I mean, to give somebody Vertigo and say, hey, watch this, I think that's asking a lot from some people, because it's just so harrowing and weird. This splits the difference nicely, and even though it just sits in the middle between two positions, I think there's a certain value in that. So, yeah, next time you're on a first date with somebody and, you know, you want that nice baseline movie while you actively try and figure out whether or not they're trying to kill you, Suspicion is your film. And, now before I steer into this winding mountain road and, let me just reach over and make sure your door is still secured. All right, Dave, You now get the wheel, and you can tell us where we're going next.
Well, after some long debate and, you know, deep inner exploration, I decided that we're going to go back to back to the 1960s, and in particular, 1964, to take a look at a little Cary Grant vehicle called Father Goose, a romantic comedy that is based on the trailer alone that I had Andrew watch will probably make for a delightful episode.
Bad films make for great listening.
Not since the VIPs have you heard an episode of the show quite like this.
The next episode of Filmstrip, now with 40% more sighing.
So tune in next week for that. And meanwhile, somebody's cursing me, wondering, like, we couldn't have watched To Catch a Thief, couldn't you? It's like, no, we're not. Yeah. But yes.
If you want to watch To Catch a Thief, by all means, listeners, start your own podcast. Until then, nobody likes a backseat driver.
Yeah. So, until then, Andrew, where can people who love Suspicion and want to chew us up reach you?
You can find me on Twitter at FilmsTripper.
That's excellent. You can find me at 24 Panels, where I will certainly be willing to listen to you, provided you aren't obnoxiously rude or bigoted or hateful. So,
well, that's not true, Dave. You listen to me all the time. And otherwise, if you want to give us some feedback and help our audience grow a little bit, 5-star reviews on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher are usually the best way. Helps get more eyes and ears on the product. And again, if there are things that you really wish we would do or really wish we wouldn't, feel free to be as honest and as critical as you'd like. I mean, we're tougher than we sound, and at the end of the day, we want to make a show that people want to listen to, and we can't fix anything if we don't know it's broken.
Though, keep in mind, it's too late to prevent us from doing Father Goose, so...
Yes, that one big asterisk out of the way.
Yeah. So, until next time, Andrew, are there any parting words that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes, there are, David. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Or will it?
Ha 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 ha